Today on the Warren Week Show podcast.
Entrepreneurs are by definition irrational, or else they wouldn't be entrepreneurs. No rational human would start a company because, like, you'd look at the data and be like, well, this seems like a bad idea. Like, you know, they almost all of them fail. Why would I do this? And so entrepreneurs are fascinating as individuals because they just never stop fighting. That's what makes them great. And so despite all of those challenges, more companies were started in the last 2 years than in any time previously in history. Entrepreneurs are fighting back. People love local. Like, so despite all of the headwinds, despite literally a direct attempt to basically ruin them, entrepreneurs survive and are thriving. And like, it is probably the greatest story of resilience in business history.
My guest today was one of the top executives at Shopify, serving as the general manager of Shopify Plus for nearly 7 years. In that role, he worked with hundreds of high-profile brands like Fashion Nova, Gymshark, and the Kardashians, to name just a few. After a brief and ultimately unfulfilling stint as a young retiree, he's back in the game as the chief operating officer of a Canadian company called Podium. This is my conversation with Lauren Paddleford. So are you ready to just roll right into it?
Yeah, man. It's your show, however you want to handle.
So thanks very much for doing this, first of all.
Pleasure.
I know you're a pretty busy guy. The first thing I'd like to, because I've seen a thread in some of the tweets that you've sent out, you're obviously on the side of the small business person. How do you think the governments overall have handled the pandemic when it comes to small business owners?
Poorly. I think the challenge for small business is, generally speaking, small business doesn't have a single voice. And so what they don't have is lobbyists, right? And so they are competing against an army of lawyers and politicians who are trying to ensure that big business stays viable, and they don't have a single representative. They don't have, like, there are small business associations, all this right. Is true, but they aren't nearly as powerful as, like, the lobbyists for these giant Fortune 500s. And so as a result, they don't get nearly enough airtime. And, you know, most politicians fundamentally don't understand the economy anyways. And so, there's this flawed sense of, while these big businesses look on the surface like they make so much money that we have to keep them open or else we're in trouble. And it's like, well, no, the vast majority of the money is made by small business. The vast majority of the employees are in small business. Like, our economies are fundamentally built on small business. They've been hurt a lot, right? Like, the forced closures that defy logic or science has put small business on the back heel when they already were on the back heel. They were already fighting consolidation and fighting conglomerates and fighting for attention. And yeah, so I think it's been challenging for them. I think it's unfortunate the way that our elected officials have understood, what small business needed. And, there's been a lack of support there. So it's been hard. It's been hard. Now, the nice part is entrepreneurs are by definition irrational, or else they wouldn't be entrepreneurs. Like, no rational human would start a company because, like, you'd look at the data and be like, well, this seems like a bad idea. Like, you know, they almost all of them fail. Why would I do this? And so entrepreneurs are fascinating as individuals because they just never stop fighting. That's what makes them great. And so despite all of those challenges, more companies were started in the last 2 years than in any time previously in history. Entrepreneurs are fighting back. People love local. Like, so despite all of the headwinds, despite literally a direct attempt to basically ruin them, entrepreneurs survived and are thriving. And like, it is probably the greatest story of resilience in business history. And so it's, you can try and put them down, but they just won't go.
Some of them, however, have gone. I think specifically the restaurant industry. And I don't know, have you lost any restaurants that were kind of like your faves over the past couple of years to the pandemic or no?
Yeah, some definitely have gone.
That's a tough unfortunate business to Zoomify or to Shopify. You know what I mean? Like some did the flip, but it's not quite the same.
It's not the same. However, even in that, it's like, you know, the speed at which some of them moved into a new model and adapted, again, I just think is resiliency. And, you know, embracing technology has allowed a lot of them to just shift their mix. I know there's a bar/restaurant here in town called Arabella. And, you know, prior to pandemic, like, you know, it's a bar, right? So you're going to the bar. So pandemic flipped, they flipped immediately into, you know, online delivery and curbside pickup and all that kind of stuff. And what they realized is they actually make more money that way. It was more efficient. They could serve more customers that way. And so when they were allowed to open, they opened because they wanted to from a social perspective, but they actually didn't need to from a business perspective. And like, that's fascinating, right? That you can just think about your business in a different way. And there was another, and the name's going to escape me, the pizza joint in Ottawa, that, you know, like honestly, like very rapidly went from normal pizza operation to direct to consumer pizza brand, right? And started like freeze packing their stuff and delivering it to people in bulk. And it was like, oh man, like that's crazy. Like that, like that's reinvention out of necessity. And they've done really well. So yeah, a lot of people went out of business. It's really hard. And that's really unfortunate, but a lot of them adapted dramatically and have actually created better businesses than they had before. And that's also really fascinating.
You have a really refreshing take on business. And in some of the things that I've heard you say, like contractor stupid, and then you'll go on, and I want to ask you about that, but you'll go on a 10-minute thing. And I completely agree that it's built to protect the business. But where do you think that attitude of yours and that kind of just that rebellious spirit, did you have that before, or was that shaped over the last decade or so from the various jobs you've had?
Yeah, I don't think I had it before. I think most of us grow up in orthodoxy, right? We grow up reading the books, and you know, the books say this is how you build a company and this is what you do and this is what successful is. And especially we all read the biographies of the people who built the other companies. I think what I've learned in the last, you know, 7-8 years and is that most of that's revisionist history and didn't actually happen that way. So when you read those books of everyone who built these great companies, you have to read them with a little bit of a squint and be like, I'm not sure this is the way it went, but this is a good story. So I can appreciate how it's being written. And so as soon as you kind of realize that, and also that you recognize that, like, technology is just so different now. The economy is so different. Business is so different. You have an opportunity to rewrite the books. And I think at Shopify is that the first place I really saw that as an operating model, which was, why do we believe all of the things we're told about how a company gets built? Has anyone checked, right? Has anyone actually tested that theory and seen if it's true that that's the way it happens? Because no one else has tried anything else. And what I found and what I've learned is more often than not, when I tried something that violated the orthodox version of how things are supposed to work, it worked. And then you had to ask a much deeper question, which is, well, how much of the stuff we're doing is now outdated and doesn't make sense and isn't good for the customers and is just the way the old guard did everything, which is not a knock, good for them, yeah. But maybe we shouldn't just repeat history over and over again. And so, yeah, I think, you know, that perspective was continually reinforced by trying things everybody said wasn't possible and then watching them work and then realizing that the reason people say it wasn't possible is they were risk averse. They were trying to protect their downside. And so they were just following the rules because the rules were safe. And the problem is you usually don't build incredible things safely, right? You have to risk things. You have to try new things to build something incredible. And so if you wanted to be good, follow the rules. If you want to be great, rewrite the books.
So you're with Shopify Plus about 6.5 years or so. And one of the last tweet you sent out talked about some of the metrics over, you know, $1 billion in revenue, 10,000 merchants. What was the craziest thing that happened to you during that time? Where I'm sure there's probably 100 of them, but where you're sitting there looking around going, holy shit, I can't believe this is happening right now.
Yeah, there were a lot. And there were a lot from a bunch of different angles. There were a lot of just incredible company moments and team moments and customer moments. And there were a lot of individual moments. For a few years there, we talked a lot about like the Kardashians, just because it was such a wild ride. But like the first time Kylie dropped lip kits on the world and the internet went nuts and we crashed, right? It was a moment because it was an inflection point. Until that point, you know, yeah, we had done some big sales. It was interesting, but the world had never seen anything like that, right? A concentrated moment of massive social influencer and like high demand product.
What were the metrics on that when it crashed?
I mean, there were millions of people on a single website trying to buy one product that there were 10,000 available, right? Like it was just a ridiculously tight funnel. And of course she had 100 million followers who were just hyping the crap out of it all. And so like the whole, you know, the joke was it was like the Hunger Games of the internet, right? It was like everyone was trying to get these things. And we were unprepared because like, you know, people say things like, oh, it's going to be big. And you're like, yeah. Everyone thinks their thing's going to be big. And, you know, we had a lot of other celebrities and like their sales are big, but they're not that big. And so like, that was an aha moment because it was like, okay. So like, two things are now true. One, man, we're going to have to make this platform way bigger than it is now and way more resilient and way more like bulletproof. And two, this is a fascinating kind of entrepreneur, like a very new entity in the world, which is like massive social influencers as brands, which was very new at that point. There, you know, it didn't exist a lot. And so this became a kind of, yeah, we talk about it now as like it's obvious and influencer marketing and influencer brands and all. It was not obvious then, right? No one had really done it at that level. And so it became two moments for us where we had to say to ourselves, are we going to build a platform that survives this kind of thing, these kind of insane atomic bomb moments? And what would it take? And are we committed to that? And then how do we help other entrepreneurs who are like this do this kind of thing, right? Because this, maybe we're uniquely positioned to do that. And I think that kicked off a moment for Shopify where we became something else, right? We became a much more powerful platform. And it became kind of the place you went if you were social influencers to create your own brands and to own your own legacy and to do something new. And both of those ended up being huge unlocks for the company as we grew, because we could just show everyone our capabilities. And so it was crazy in the moment because like it was so wild and it was so much bigger than anything we had ever seen. And you know, it's like, it's in those moments, it's when you fail, when you have to make the best choices, right? And yeah, I think great companies are forged in chaos, right? And that was chaos, right? It was like the building's burning. What do we do now? And we chose the right path and, you know, built the next version of Shopify on top of it.
So wasn't Shopify Plus created to capture brands and companies from kind of they would get on the platform, get to a certain size, and then just like you talked about earlier, those assumptions. Well, we have to go to the bigger, you know, one of the, what do you call them, the internet mafia companies or whatever, right? So wasn't it built to capture those companies from leaving?
Yes. Most software companies, or a lot of software companies, start in SMB. They start with small companies. And inevitably, the allure of big companies, usually the money, a big company shows up somewhere early and says, I'll pay you a lot of money to do this thing for me. And that's attractive because when you're small, you need money. So most people start drifting up market. And the challenge is, of course, that like that upmarket customer needs very different things than the SMB. And so you end up bastardizing your platform a lot and customizing things. And then that's a trap, right? It's a trap. You know, it's very hard to get out of. And it requires you do a lot of things to your company that probably are bad long term. Okay, so that's generally what happens. And you can just watch that story over and over again in the world. And that's how most companies end in the enterprise, right? Because it's like, oh, look at how much money they have. Okay, great. Shopify was never that. I mean, it held and continually holds to its core principle of like, job is to help small businesses and entrepreneurs create their companies and sell online. However, when you have that many small businesses doing this, every once in a while, one of them has a really good idea and executes it extremely well, and it becomes a much bigger company. And so that started to happen on Shopify. So if you look at like the Gymsharks of the world or the Allbirds of the world, or like, you know, just like Fashion Nova and all these companies, they had started on Shopify. They were like startups on Shopify, but they were really good at what they did and they got a lot bigger. Well, it created a conundrum is the platform wasn't actually built to support larger customers. That was never the intent, but here we are, our own customers, very successful growing up. And so it was another inflection point, a choice that Shopify had to make, which was, do we continue to try and support our own customers as they grow? So do we scale as they scale? Or do we offload them to another platform and say, hey, look, it's great. We love that you started here, but we aren't built for that. And so we're going to help you get to your next place and go on. I think for all the obvious reasons, we thought offloading was crazy. And why would we let the best yeah. examples of our customer group leave? And so it became, well, how do we keep them, right? Well, how do we keep supporting them? How do we keep scaling with them? And that became the, you know, genesis of Plus. Is Plus was there to help to scale alongside these customers and to help provide additional services and additional features and functions and capabilities for customers who are scaling past the kind of like normal situation. So that was its original intent. And to be fair, that was all we intended to do. Like there wasn't a conscious choice that said, oh, you know what, there's this like enterprise market or mid-market and we could go get it. It was more just, hey, we have to keep supporting our customers and they keep getting bigger. And so let's build the things that they need. The knock-on effect, of course, is then you ended up building a platform that lots of people could use. And, you know, a lot of folks who weren't on Shopify who were larger started to see the power of Shopify and decided they would leave their legacy platforms and come over to Plus. And so you kind of supporting your own customers and supporting a market who lacked, you know, good software. So it's kind of worked out for everybody.
The Gymshark story in particular, I love. And I got to meet Ben in, I think it was 2017. It was part of the Build a Bigger Business contest, and they had won. And so I'm walking down the street reading this. I did a media training session with him and one of his colleagues. And I'm reading the sheet, and I'm like, what the hell is a Gymshark? And I'm trying to imagine what this company is. And I thought it was like sport ball, something you do with your kid. And then I walk in and you know what he looks like. He's this kid. He's like this fresh faced, smiling, but you know, jacked kid. And I started asking him about the business and when did you start it? And you know, my grandma taught me how, or my nan taught me how to sew. And what did you do in business last year? He's like $100 million. My jaw just about hit the floor. But is this the new model of the entrepreneur? Like how uncommon is a Ben Francis in terms of like, you've met thousands of people like this. How special is he?
Yeah, I mean, Ben is special. Gymshark is special. You know, I think if you think about like entrepreneurs now, they have such a different option with the internet than historical. And what I mean by that is niche markets on a global level are enormous. And so what you see is increasingly thin slices of markets being created, right? It used to be that store and that you had to try and be everything. And you don't see that anymore, not in direct to consumer, right? Which is the biggest, you know, entrepreneurial lever in decades, is I can now decide exactly who I think my customer is to a minute level of detail and totally focus my brand and my experience on that customer. But because I can do it on the internet, that customer group is now globally scaled, which means it's enormous. And Gymshark is kind of a primary example of this. It's not like athletic wear didn't exist. There are companies called like Nike Lulu and Reebok. So it's a thing that already existed in the world. But what Ben and Seb and Noel and, you know, all that whole crew realized is, but they were like peanut butter. They were good for everybody, but not good for the niche that Ben was, right? Which was kids who just love the gym. And so he's like, well, I'm just going to make clothes for me. I'm going to make it because I don't really like Nike. That's for everybody. I want stuff that's specifically engineered for gym people, right? And you think, oh, well, that's a very tight niche. And it's like, yes, it is a very tight niche, but at scale, it's a very big niche. And so they just focused and they said, you know what? If you're not one of this group, right, we're not really interested in talking to you and we're not going to try and talk to you. We're going to build our marketing. We're going to build our products. We're going to build our brand very specifically for this very tight niche. And that's all we're going to do. We're going to build a community around this idea. And, you know, that's what they did. And they just relentlessly did it and never deviated and never deviated and never deviated and created. And so what happened was everyone who was like Ben was like, oh man, a brand got built for me. And that is the power of DTC, is you can create brands that speak directly to an audience and are marketed directly to a very specific audience. And you can create that rabid community and that cult-like behavior in a very specific audience who just relates to your brand in a way that has never really been possible before and can interact with your brand on social media and can, and like Ben is out there talking and responding to his customers. And it's just like this type of entrepreneur has never really existed like that before. And so you can grow. And this is what I always thought was fascinating about Shopify, was how many very large companies were being built in what would seem like secret. And it wasn't secret. It was just, they didn't care if you knew about them because you weren't their customer. They weren't trying to buy billboards or TV ads that hoped everyone in the world would see it. They were very hyper-targeted on their customer group. And so they got very large behind the scenes. You know, there were customers that if they were in public, if they were publicly traded, they'd be top five retailers in the world. No one even knew their names because you didn't have to know their name. Crazy. Like you weren't their customer. And so like, that is just like, I used to talk to folks, I'd go and be like, do you think it's possible that you could grow a $1 billion retail company without ever doing a store or a newspaper ad or a billboard or a traditional marketing? And the answer was always no. And I was like, well, I got bad news for you. We got multiples, right? On Shopify doing this right now. And everyone was like, how is that even possible? I was like, internet. I don't know. Right. While Ben is special and like those Gymsharks are rare, the idea of going direct to consumer and that specificity that you can drive there is the unlock. It is why you see such growth in that space and why you see the disruption of traditional brands happening everywhere. It's, you know, everyone's sitting around going, well, I don't want generic. I want something very specifically to what geared to me, towards me and what I want. And like, that's the opportunity that they have now.
What a great line. Niche markets on a global level are enormous. So I have a minuscule example of this from my own business. So I've been grinding away for 27 years, almost 19 on my own. And you know, as you've seen, my service is very old school. Like I'm a guy that makes shoes, except it's media training, right? I go out, it's brains by the pound, by the hour, just repeat, rinse, hotel, airplane, repeat, repeat, repeat. So the pandemic hits and a third of a year of business just disappears overnight. Just ding, ding, ding. Every time the email goes, you realize it's a session gone. So I have the first break that I've had in almost two decades. And, you know, I watched Tiger King and like everybody else, but I thought I wanted to challenge myself. And I saw these restaurants and these farmers that are going online. I thought, can I digitize what I do? And so I spent 3.5 months putting together this online version. I tell people, look, if I got hit by a bus later today, I would be happy with this standing in for the best version of what I do. And even having built the thing was kind of like embarrassed about it. Like it's, you know, it's not really me in the room and no one's going to want it. And with, you know, I sent out some emails, some tweets, and that thing generated $53,000 in 11 months. In the first sale, I was in bed. I was in bed on a Saturday scrolling through and you hear that little cash register and you realize, holy shit, the internet is just this frictionless machine. And, it, you know, to look at it on a scale of these other businesses, it's such, I don't think people really get it.
Yeah. Most people's experience with technology is TV. I mean that sincerely. It's like most of the population's experience with technology or their expectation of technology is like, you know, the computer on the Starship Enterprise, right? Like, and so everyone's like, oh, yeah. And we talk and you hear about technology all the time. You hear it in the news. So your impression is the technology is everywhere, right? That it is ubiquitous at the moment. The problem is it's not. The fascinating truth is we might be at 1% technology against like the traditional mechanisms, 1%. And this is where you hear the technology is eating the world. It's like, there's so much space to create efficiency and to create scale and to create opportunity for people in technology. It's kind of hard to wrap your head around. Like it just exists everywhere. So what you're describing is this nascent idea of like, well, I could be always on. And well, yes, technology allows people to be always on. So the internet was great, but like technology in general. So like, you know, as I left Shopify and moved into Podium, it was offline companies, like a different style of customer, right? Still small businesses, but like tire shops, hairdressers, who you don't think about like as online entities, but technology allows them to be always on as well. So they're always selling, always scheduling, always interacting. And like, that is a monster of an unlock. And so, yes, but we're so early. Like, it is very hard to describe how early we are in the tech super cycle. I think people look at the tech companies and they say, man, these companies are already the biggest corporations in history. And it's like, yeah, and we're 1% into it. Wow. So like,
mind-boggling.
This is never going to end. And what it is it is a leveraged unlock of human potential. And so it gives everybody, it lowers the barrier of entry to everything because it makes it suddenly you have the same technology as the Fortune 100.
Yeah.
And suddenly you are global as a single human can go global overnight. This is unprecedented and like it's hard, like it's still even hard to comprehend what this will mean economically as people get to it. And so I think, you know, it's easy to believe we've solved all the problems because it kind of like feels that way. But when you start really looking at it, you realize, oh man, it's just, we've solved none of the problems. Like we solved the most obvious problems, but like there's so much space here. And I think that's why it's so incredible. And that's why you see entrepreneurism raging back is because we're, you know, companies like Shopify, companies like Podium are reducing the barrier to entry, making it easier. So more people can start and be more successful. Great. Like this is decentralization at its finest, right? And like this is how the people take back the economy. And it's kind of mesmerizing to watch and be part of. And it's empowering as well, because like, these are also the greatest stories in just in history. Entrepreneurs are the greatest stories. Like, you've never, like, emotions and family and struggle and success. And like, it's just like every single story, you're just like, oh my God, like, you could be your own mini series. And so, yeah, it's amazing. And what you experienced is kind of like the tip of the potential. And so, yeah, it's going to be a fun few decades as like tech just unlocks more and more opportunity.
As objectively as you can, where would you rank Toby in the CEOs of major companies in the world right now?
That's such an interesting question. Toby does a lot of things incredibly well, which make him an incredible CEO and an incredible founder. Probably the most impactful for, you know, in my opinion, for Shopify's ability to grow was the quality bar he held. Most companies are good with good, right? Their software is good, right? Their processes are good, right? Their experiences are good, right? And that's good. You can build a big company off of good. Toby never liked good, right? He was never happy with good, right? His perspective was our options were great or nothing, right? And he held that bar. And, you know, that bar was a hard bar. Like, it was hard to get there. And you were sent back to the well over and over again because you just didn't meet it. And he would not relent. And, you know, you could kick and scream and talk about physics and the defined logic and how this couldn't be done and all. And he would just hold. And he'd be like, I'm sorry, like, figure it out. And so what it required, and I think what the unlock was, is it forced everyone to be far more creative. It forced everyone to think tangentially about how to do things because the normal ways weren't going to get there. And it demanded everyone be better. And when you do that with a collection of people and a scale group of people, what you get is monster end results, right? Hard, like not easy to do, and would have been far easier for him to just relent every once in a while and just be like, it's okay, we can ship something that's good this time, right? Or it's okay, we don't have to hit that bar this time, right? And probably would have made his life easier as well, but he didn't. And what you got was Shopify, right? Which was a company that just was relentlessly chasing great, and whose people were having to become great because that was the standard. And you just knew that, like, if you showed up with something that wasn't great, wasn't going to go well. And so I think as a founder and as a CEO, that capacity made Shopify something that was very hard to challenge, and very hard to compete with, because it was relentless. I think it's hard to argue with his success. It's hard to argue Shopify's success. And I think as a CEO, those are that is a trait that is ultra, ultra rare, right? People compromise constantly, right? In business and in companies, CEOs compromise constantly on things, because it's efficient or it drives short-term results or, you know, it's safer or whatever. And it's like, yeah, great. Again, you will build a good company that way. I don't think Toby was interested in building a good company. Right? So, you know, so I think, yeah. It was something I learned from him, definitely, is that bar and don't relent. And I think you see it in Shopify as why it performs the way that it does.
So you clearly don't need to work anymore. And you tweeted that, going to spend some time with family and friends. And now let's say you're like Al Pacino in Godfather 3, they've pulled you back in. What was it? Tell us a little bit about Podium, but also what was it that made you jump back into the, onto the merry-go-round?
Yeah. So I had an incredible experience at Shopify. I grew tremendously as a person, as a business person, as a leader. I failed constantly. I learned a lot. I got rebuilt. It was just incredible from top to bottom. Shopify was a monster success. So like I benefited from that as well. So when I decided to leave after about 7 years, a lot of folks were like, oh yeah, man, you should retire, go do something else. Like, don't do anything. Just like take time off. I was like, yeah, that makes sense. Like in my head, I was like, this makes sense. I was tired at that point. And so I was like, yeah, retirement sounds good. Okay, cool. So I'll retire. I'll take time off, blah, blah, blah. That was probably true for about 2 weeks. I was like, yeah, I like this. I like being off. This is good. And then, I was like sitting in my cottage and I was looking around. And I was like, okay, I'm done. This has been great. I can't do this forever. And so the metaphor I like is that I think SaaS software is the pro league of business. It is brutally competitive, right? It's got incredibly intelligent people in it. And so, if it's the pro league and the companies are the teams, then we're all the athletes, right? And, I grew up playing sports. And so in my mind, I'm an athlete who likes to play. And so cool. We won a championship by some measure. I don't know. Right. And so it's great, but you didn't see like Tom Brady be like, oh, I won a Super Bowl. I'm retired now. I'm never coming back. Right. And don't get me wrong. I'm not comparing myself to Tom Brady. It's the point I'm making is like athletes don't usually retire after winning things. They come back. They want to play again. This was my mental model, right? It's like, I wanted to play again. I like the sport. It's fun. It's challenging. It's invigorating. There are big rewards and big risks. And like, that's exciting to me. And so I wasn't done with playing. And so then it became if you're going to go back and play, what do you want to play? Right. And I'd had a great experience at Shopify. And so I got some great advice from a number of folks that I, trust and respect. And one of the pieces of advice was go find an incredible idea and a great team. Because that's all that matters, right? The rest of it's irrelevant, right? Like find a good idea that you think has big potential and a great team. And so I went on that journey trying to do that. And I talked to probably 150 different companies and a bunch of VCs and a bunch of PE firms and like everyone trying to figure out like who had the right idea. And you saw lots of companies who had great ideas and mediocre teams. You saw some great teams with mediocre ideas. You saw just a ton of cool tech out there of like stuff. You're like, man, that is cool. But like, I don't know how you're going to get it to where you think you're going to go. So like lots of like really interesting conversations. And then got connected to Podium. And Podium helps small businesses communicate with their customers. And so it's everything from marketing communication over text. So text messaging, so I can schedule appointments with folks. I can get payments via text messaging. I can manage all of my communications, that kind of stuff. So I started talking to Eric, who's their founder, and the first conversation was he told me the story about his dad and his dad's tire shop and like how he had started an online store on Shopify to sell notebooks, and he had better tech than his dad's company, who was 500 times the size of his. And he was just like, this seemed wrong. So I started to build technology for my dad. And I was like, man, I kind of love this story. It sounds like you're really familiar in a lot of ways. And the more I dug, the more I realized, hey, this SMB market of companies who are primarily offline and primarily services oriented has been left alone by the technology companies because it's not the cool, sexy online stuff. And so there was a huge market there. There's 10 million like offline service oriented companies in the United States alone. Right. So this is a gigantic market that nobody's really paying attention to. And they had already gotten to 100,000 customers. They had already cleared. Podium was bigger than Shopify was when Shopify went public.
Wow.
And Podium's still private. And so check the box of big idea. It's like, okay, you're going to help small local offline businesses win. I like this idea, right? Big. hard, really freaking hard, because like this is probably the most technophobic group of entrepreneurs in the world, right? It's like they never needed technology to get to where they were, and they don't trust it now. And so it's like, okay, so now you got to crack that code versus the online guys who are already technology oriented, right? And then team, passionate, excited, connected to the mission, smart, had gotten it to that scale, right? And I was just like, okay, so you checked. So I really, you know, I went through this whole process trying to eliminate companies. Like I was brutal in conversations because I was like, if I'm going to go back and play, it's going to have to be worth it. And so I just like ripped companies apart during conversations because I was like, I don't know. And I just kept trying to eliminate them and couldn't. And then at the end, I was like, well, I guess we're doing this because like I can't find, like you check all the boxes, let's go do it. And so joined in November and yeah, really excited. Like there's a lot of similarities to Shopify and like small businesses unlock with technology, big leverage, but there's a lot of differences too. It's like, it's a different customer. If it's a different platform and experience, you know, and a different group of people. Right. So excited by it. I think it has a lot of potential. But early days, right? It's kind of nice to be back in a smaller business. Different problems.
Congratulations on that.
Yeah, thank you.
One of the things that keeps popping up when people are in your tweets, and I have to say, you're one of the few people that responds to every note that someone puts on Twitter. You respond with a nice little, not just, hey, how you doing? Or you give them a nice compliment. You're right in there. And very few people do that. So just wanted to flag that and say, I thought that was great. The thing that keeps popping up is storytelling. People say, I want to hear your riff on storytelling. Why are so many, and it's a word that gets overused, and what's your narrative, what's your story? And so many companies do it poorly. If you had a couple minutes to talk to a business leader about what it is and some advice you'd give them, what would it be?
Yeah. I think when you're in the echo chamber of technology, especially, but just in the echo chamber of business, you can very rapidly develop a very skewed version of how human beings operate. And that version is that human beings operate logically. The problem is humans don't operate logically ever. I mean, humans are emotional. They're not logical, right? Very rarely do humans do things that are logical. They talk in logic, right? But they operate in emotion. The other thing is, we survived as a species because we told each other stories. We didn't survive because we wrote technical manuals on how to survive, right? We survived because we transferred information through allegory and through metaphor and through story. And why that worked is because humans are emotional first before they're logical. And you can engage a story emotionally. Stories have story arcs that are usually emotionally driven. And so human can bind to that and can understand it's simple before they can understand the technical. Okay. So because those things are true, and I didn't make that up, like that's just fact, right? What I find a lot of business leaders do and a lot of companies do is they engage their people and they engage their customers and they engage the market in technical truth. So they're all running around talking about the features and functions of their application or the thing that they do. And everyone's like, yeah, but why does that matter? Why do I care? It's like, oh, right. You forgot to tell them why it's important. Like you forgot to tell them the story, the why, right? The Simon Sinek, you know, start with why. And so that applies to everything. It applies to marketing. It applies to recruiting. It applies to, you know, HR. It applies to promotions. It applies to media. It applies to everything. It's like the best companies are storytelling companies. They're not technical telling companies. They do have technicals and they will get there, but they get to story first. So the examples I like to use is like, most of the brands we think are the greatest brands in the world haven't told us a technical truth in decades. It's actually sometimes even hard to figure out what products they sell, right? So there's a really interesting example of this right now. It's like there's a new ad for an Apple Watch. It's a wave. That's all it is. It's just a picture of a wave. And then in the bottom, says Apple Watch. What the fuck does a wave have to do with Apple Watch? Right? And it's like, that's not what they're trying to do. The wave is supposed to evoke an emotion, right? So it's a story they're trying to tell you. This is brilliant, right? Because it's like, yes, people don't buy Apple Watches because they're the best watches in the world. They buy them because it's an experience they want. It's a story they're involved in. They want that luxury. They want that emotion that comes with it. Nike does this probably better than anybody. Story-driven sales. So I think if I'm any kind of leader in any kind of business or in anything for that matter, the thing I recommend, and I think the thing I see the very few people do, is storytell. They don't start with story. They start with technical. And so I just think if you want humans to do exceptional things, they don't do it because it's technically accurate. They do it because they're emotionally bound to it. That has always been true. If you want to use the most extreme example of this is armies aren't motivated to war because it's technically an accurate thing to do. Like the generals don't stand on stage and the president or the country leaders don't get up and say, at 43 degrees northwest of this, we're going to at 1200 hours. Because everyone's going to be like, what? You want me to die for like a technical reality? Like, no. What they do is they tell stories, right? Good versus evil, us versus them, right? Your families, your like, and everyone's like, fuck yeah, I'm in, right? This is what moves countries, humans, organizations, is emotion and story. And it is underinvested in. Very few people do it. Everyone thinks their products win. Products don't win. I'm sorry. Products don't win. Like I love products. And it's not that you can't have shitty product. You can't. You have to have really great product. But by itself, product doesn't win. It never has. It never will. Product and story rules. And so I think as leaders, it is to your own detriment not to learn how to tell a story, how to explain to folks what and why. And how to evoke emotion. Because if you really want the best out of them, that's the only way to get it. You might get them to come to work and do their jobs because of the technical thing you're doing, but you won't get them to go above and beyond because of it. So I think, my advice every time, it's like, the first question I ask is tell me the story. And you know what's fascinating? I'll tell you people are like, oh, I'm a terrible storyteller. It's like, really? Why'd you start this company? They tell you the greatest story you've ever heard. And you're like, oh, so tell me again why you're a terrible storyteller. Right? It's like, for some reason, we've disconnected storytelling from like our normal life. We tell stories all the time. Whenever you meet your friend and your friend's like, so how's your week going? A story envelops, right? It's like, we are natural storytellers. It's just suddenly we walk through the front door of an office and we're like, storytelling is some magical thing no one knows how to do. And it's like, no, just stand there and be excited about what you're doing. So I think everyone has storytelling in them. And it seems fluffy and it's just like, man, it's so powerful. It's so powerful.
This is this could be a masterclass for you or a book or something, because it's, and I think you struck on something really interesting. People think they're not good at it because they think it's a different thing, right? They're thinking it's something else. So, I saw in your Twitter bio, you're an amateur EDM DJ. I need to know about that.
Oh boy. Okay. So I grew up going to raves. I grew up in the, I was a drinking age individual, in the late 90s and early 2000s. And so I went to raves. I was really big into house music and trance and that kind of stuff. So I went to all the clubs in Toronto and big, warehouse raves and field raves and stuff like that. So I kind of fell in love with DJs because DJs have this like magical power to control large groups of humans with just music. And that was fascinating to me. It was also technical, right? It was like lots of wizardry up there with shit, hands were moving. I don't know what they were doing, right? But I loved them. I loved the way I felt, right, with the music. I loved their ability to just move people, right? So I've always loved DJs. So that's always been like a thing that I was really attracted to. And then I was at Shopify. And I made like an offhand comment in a meeting about, like, if something happened, I would DJ the Christmas party. And my team, being the great individuals they were, like, just took that and ran. And so then, like, they co-opted the whole company into, like, ensuring that thing happened so that I would have to DJ the Christmas party. Yeah. And so, like, it happened, and they were like, so you're DJing the Christmas party. I was like, well, that was a joke. And they're like, yeah, no, it's not a joke. Like, you have to DJ the Christmas party. Yeah, we told everyone you're going to DJ the Christmas party. And I was like, but I don't know how to DJ. I've never DJed before in my life. Right. It was just like, it was a joke. And they're like, sorry, figure it out.
Get practicing.
Yeah. And so, like, that was the Christmas party before.
Right.
So January 1 of 2019, I bought a little DJ deck and some speakers and went on YouTube and started to learn how to DJ. And I just worked at it and watched videos and tried stuff. And, like, and so I did for the whole year. I worked on it. Right. And I DJed the Christmas party. And it was great. I loved it. And I mean, I don't know if I was any good, but, like, I loved it. So, like, you know, it was great. And so then, you know, I kind of was like, oh, wow, this is a lot of fun. And so, I've subsequently DJed a couple, like, house parties and stuff like that. And I have the decks in my house. I play with them every once in a while. That's just great. Because, like, to me, it's magic. It's magic what you can do with DJ decks. And so, yeah, that was an example of maybe shooting my mouth off and then getting my bluff called.
That's hilarious.
But I'm glad it happened.
Just a couple more. I want to respect your time. I know you have a job to get to. Are you a gamer?
Yes.
And if so, what are your big games right now?
Yeah, so I kind of drift around. Main game that I play is World of Warcraft.
Oh, yeah. Wow, classic.
Yeah. Yeah, we've got a bunch of friends who have a guild, and so we run around doing stuff. It's kind of great social time and just, like, fun to play. Leveling up is fun, so I play World of Warcraft.
What levels your character? It must be crazy at this point.
Well, they max out. You can only have a level 60 character, but then you go to gear, and so I think I have 185 level gear, and so, like, I don't know. It sounds impressive, but then you realize, you know, WoW is one of those games that, like, people lose entire years to.
Oh, yeah.
And so some of these folks that are in this, people I play with, like, their levels are insane. And, like, you know, I mean, it's very cool. So, yeah. Sometimes I'll play. So I'm also, like, on PS5, I'm waiting for God of War. So God of War is probably my favorite, like, single player game. It is an incredible story. Like, again, story shows up everywhere. Yeah. It's like, yeah, it's a game and it's technical, but, like, it is the story that makes that thing so incredible. And so the new one comes out this year, so I'm excited for that. And every once in a while I'll play, you know, Rainbow Six as a first person shooter. And then the other one is I have a big racing rig to play F1 in. So one of those full, like, seats and steering wheels and everything. So I like gaming. It's fun, challenging. It's social, but it's also kind of weirdly alone time. Yeah. Like, it's social and alone time all at once, which I kind of like. But yeah, I like gaming.
And are you a podcast guy? Do you listen to any?
Not so much. Like, every once in a while someone will send me a really cool, I listen to a lot of, like, science podcasts and, like, space podcasts just because I find them fascinating. And so, like, I probably Radiolab is probably the ones I listen to the most because they're the most, like, fascinating, totally fucked up stories. Like, so I'm listening to one now about, you know, how the Walkman basically, like, changed planet Earth, right? Like, it's just like these butterfly effect stories are so cool. So, but I know people are, like, way more into podcasts than I am, but I do like them. Like, every once in a while I'll get one. I'll be like, yeah, this is really cool.
If there's one book or a couple of books you had to recommend to people that you think are, like, life changers or just really great books, what would they be?
Yeah. So fiction, Three Body Problem. So I don't know how you read that book and are the same after. It is freaking mind blowing. So that one I'm a big fan of. Nonfiction, anything by, if you want to just read books and at the end have to sit quietly by yourself and contemplate the nature of the universe anything by the author, his name is Carlo Rovelli. He's a quantum physicist, and he writes these beautifully written books. So his latest one is one called Helgoland. But they're all about the nature of reality as described by quantum mechanics. They are all at once incredible and disturbing and like fascinating. But they're those books that you sit there and you're like, I don't know what to do now, because if this is true, what is the world? Right. And it's just, you know, so I love those kinds of things because it just expands horizons. If you're in business and you want great leadership books, Extreme Ownership, which was written by two Navy SEALs, is incredible just because it, you know, I think in my opinion, it directly addresses a lot of the myths that business leaders can get themselves wrapped up in around hero behavior and people are expendable and all this bullshit that is just totally untrue. And so you have Navy SEALs who live in life and death, who spend their whole book telling you how like people matter, right? And like, there are no bad people. There's just bad leaders and all, like all this kind of, and it's just like, fuck yeah. Multipliers is another one as a leadership book. Yeah, I read a lot. So like, I found that every once in a while you'll run across a book that the whole thing is just a mind fuck, right? And you're like, holy crap, this whole thing is incredible. Most of the time, there's at least one or two incredible aspects of every book, or every blog, or every, like whatever it is. And so I think in my experience, the thing you notice about most highly successful people is they're rabid consumers of information.
Yeah.
Right. And so I encourage everyone to just read a lot.
What a life hack. Like I was talking to my daughters, and you have two daughters. I do as well. I said, look, you can take, someone has had 20 or 30 years of experience. They compressed it into this book and you can put that in your head in a couple of days.
Yeah.
Rinse and repeat. And like you won't find a leader, a great, successful person who hasn't read a shitload of books.
Totally. 100%.
So last question, as a girl dad, what has surprised you about that? Or and again, not to get too philosophical at the end here, but I've got two girls, you do as well. What have you learned about that you didn't know before they came into the world?
Yeah. I mean, a lot, as we all do. Like you learn a lot about them. You learn a lot about yourself. I think a couple of things, I am in awe of how rapidly they develop, like how smart they are, how soon, right? Like, I misunderstood kids, but like, I assume like, you know, until they're teenagers, you can probably outsmart them. I was like, they were five and they were twisting me. And I was like, okay, I'm so screwed at this point. Right. So, a lot of it's just like, geez, man, they develop quick. Right. And they are watching everything. Right. That's the other thing. It's like, they see everything. And so if you think you're pulling the wool over them, you're not. Right. So that's one. And then I'm a white male born in North America. I'm the most privileged human on planet Earth. Right. And so the world was designed to ensure I'm successful. And the trope is, and it sucks to say, but it's true. It's like, I don't think I was even remotely aware of how the world is set up to subjugate girls and women from the get, right? Until I had my own and saw it in real life and was like, holy shit, this thing is designed to put them into second class citizenry, and to push them down a very old version of like equality and expectation and stuff like that. And it is heartbreaking in a lot of ways because you feel, you just don't know what to do with that. Right. But it's pervasive and relentless and subtle and and insidious. And so it's frustrating. It's like, I love them and I want the best for them, but you do have to, you end up fighting social structure a lot with girls, right? And reminding them that they are, you know, just as good and equal and capable as the boys, and you know, and it's like when they're young, they know, but you can, you start to see it. Like mine are 12 and 10, and you start to, as they get older, you start to see the twist, and you're just like, oh no, 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 we cannot let this happen. And so that's, I should have been aware of that. And like, I have only myself to blame for taking, like for requiring that. I realized that once I had daughters, but yeah, it's the part that I, you know, I now am aggressively fighting against, because, you know, unfortunately now it's personal, right? And it wasn't before, and that's a shitty thing to say, but that's, I mean, unfortunately that's the truth. But they are fascinating, right? You know, yeah, it's, you don't really realize how much your own life and how your own personality changes when you're putting in the role of dad, for kids of any gender, but like little girls, especially when you come from, like, from me, like the high macho athletic background, it's just like, girls are total, like, bring you back to reality, moment.
Anything else you want to mention before we close it out?
No, I think we covered a lot, right? You know, I think here's what I tell all entrepreneurs that I encounter and all people that I encounter who are talking about like starting companies or businesses. And here's my one piece of like consistent advice. Don't believe the rules. They were written by others. So until you know they're true for you, break them all. Right? That's how innovation happens.
Perfect way to end it. Lauren, thank you very much for doing this. All the best to you and your family. And I hope that we can do this in person at some point with some beverages in front of us.
Yeah, absolutely. Thanks. It's been fun. Appreciate it.
Big thanks once again to Lauren for taking the time to speak with me. And as always, thanks to you for taking the time to listen. Please take a moment to rate, review, or recommend the show. Helps other people find this content. Thanks once again, and we'll see you next time.